The first time I showed my mom a scene from Silicon Valley, she said, Jimmy, how many times do I have to tell you? Don't hunch your back. Mom, this is acting. I'm playing a character. Can you play a character that stands up straight? You look weak. I gave up trying to explain myself. Nothing has changed. I used to think being on TV meant I would be living like the stars on MTV Cribs in a mansion with 3 Ferraris, a pet tiger in the backyard, and models lining up in front of my house waiting to date me. Nope. I still drive a Prius, I still use Tinder, and I still dwell in a 1-bedroom apartment, which is already a massive upgrade from living with Terrell and Guam in my closet. I get recognized once in a while at a local bowling alley, and I get a free beer if I'm lucky. Fans always come up to me and ask, Are you Jing Yang? I don't mind being called Jing Yang, but I've noticed there's always a hesitation when they ask me that question. Because if I wasn't the guy to play Jing Yang and I was just some random Asian guy, they would look super racist. I'm sure there were other Asians who had been asked that question and dared to respond, Not all Asian people look alike, you asshole. Then some people are shocked when they find out I sound nothing like Jing Yang. Oh my god, we love Silicon Valley. We didn't even know you speak English in real life. We thought that was your real accent. I bet nobody's ever said to Johnny Depp, Oh my god, we love you in Pirates of the Caribbean. We thought you were a pirate in real life. Because that's fucking stupid. The majority of people who watch Silicon Valley are dudes. 95% of girls who have come up to me always say, Oh my god, my boyfriend is a huge fan of Silicon Valley. Can I take a picture of you? It will make him so happy. Sure, I'll make your boyfriend's day. Meanwhile, I was still trying to find myself a girlfriend on Tinder. It's pretty awkward to be a quasi-celebrity on Tinder. Some girls don't believe it's really me. I mean, who the hell would use my picture as their fake profile picture? That's counterproductive. The girls who do believe it's me would always message me Jing Yang quotes from Silicon Valley. Most of their messages start with, I eat the fish! I used to think it's a clear sign that she's into me if she's a fan of the show. I used to reply with some small talk like, Oh, so what's your favorite sushi restaurant? Or another line from the show like, What about garbage? Yes, it was super fucking lame. And I've since learned my lesson to not engage with someone who matched with me only because I'm on TV. I once took this Tinder girl out on a dinner date. She was a very attractive girl from Orange County who had mentioned she was a big fan of Silicon Valley. My naivete led me to believe that I was in for the win. We chit-chatted about life and she asked me a few questions about working on Silicon Valley. She seemed like a sweet girl who was genuinely curious about my career. I swiped my credit card and threw down a 30% tip like I was a series regular on Everybody Loves Raymond. Then I smoothly asked her, Do you want to go grab a drink after this? And she said, How about we go back to your place? I'm like, Whoa! Being on a TV show is like some kind of magical aphrodisiac. This is amazing! So when we hopped into my 2006 Prius, I felt like I needed to explain why I wasn't driving a Ferrari. This thing gets like 50 miles a gallon. It's an amazing car. I wanted her to think that maybe I could totally afford a Ferrari, but I chose to drive a Prius because I'm a hero who cares about the environment. So I took the more roundabout scenic route in the neighborhood where we passed by fancy multi-million dollar mansions before we finally arrived at my shabby, shitty apartment. The old metal garage gate of my apartment complex swung open and I turned the radio up to cover up the rusty creak. I love this song! I yelled over the newest Ariana Grande single. When we got to my place, I asked her, Do you want something to drink? And without hesitation, she said, Let's go to your bedroom. Holy shit, this being on TV thing is really fucking awesome. Then she followed me into my room and she said, Can I look into your closet? Okay. Maybe celebrities are supposed to have sex in the closet. I'm down to try anything. I don't know. So I showed her to my closet. It was filled with unimpressive clothes from Ross. But at least there wasn't a dude named Guam sleeping in there. She didn't say a word and started to shuffle through my clothes. I wasn't sure where this was going anymore. So I joked, So, are you like looking for a new outfit or something? And she turned around and we locked eyes. This was my moment. I leaned in for the kiss. and she pushed me away like Emma Smith viciously stiff-arming a linebacker. "Will, I think you got the wrong idea," she said. "Wrong idea? You invited yourself back to my place, then into my bedroom, then into my closet. What idea am I supposed to have?" I was completely stumped. Then she said, "Oh, I just wanted to see how you lived and what you have in your closet, but maybe I should go." What is that supposed to mean? See how I lived and what I have in my closet? What kind of sick shit is that? What is this, an episode of MTV Cribs? I was beyond confused. I guess she literally just wanted to see what I had in my closet. Maybe she was an aspiring costume designer. Maybe my car and apartment weren't balling enough for her. Or maybe she was just a crazy person. She left, and I never went out with a Silicon Valley fan from Tinder again. Like most people in this world, I thought achieving my goals would solve all my life's problems. But it didn't change much at all. There's satisfaction and achievement, but the excitement is always in the chase. Looking back, some of the happiest times of my life were working at the Comedy Palace for minimum wage, folding envelopes with Terrell and Guam. Even though none of us had any money, we had a great time just hanging out. I was so poor, I would go into the kitchen and sneak out leftover prime rib with a side of beef barley soup. Once a fortnight, the comedians went out to Denny's after the shows. That was a special treat. I had to save up to get a $10 moons over my hammy sandwich at Denny's. But that ham sandwich meant something to me. I earned it by doing what I loved, and it tasted just as good as the salmon at the Golden Globes party. One night, after the Comedy Palace shows, Terrell Guam and our other comedian friend Jason Lawhead and I were chopping it up over a Grand Slam breakfast at 2 o'clock in the morning. I said to my boys, "Guys, I think the new waitress really likes me. She was like giving me some signals. She..." "Jimmy," Jason interrupted me, "listen, her boyfriend drives a Bentley and you were stealing soup in the kitchen." We all folded over laughing. We're all so busy chasing our goals, sometimes we forget about the thrill of the chase. We only realized the goal wasn't a prize when we get there. It was cool to be in the same room with Sir Pat Stew and Jana Ann, but I honestly had more fun at Denny's than the Golden Globes party. Maybe Charles Dickens and our UCSD Chancellor Fox did have a point after all. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times, it was the age of wisdom, it was the age of foolishness, and it was the age of stealing soup. I had achieved one of my wildest dreams when I became a series regular in Silicon Valley, but I felt more lost than ever. Now what? I was meandering in my apartment not knowing what to do next in my life. I panicked. It was scary to feel empty in the presence of success. So I called my mentor, Sean Kelly, as I always do when I'm lost. I asked Sean, "So what should I do now?" And he said, "Start back at square one with an even crazier goal." Then I realized, the chase is never over. I just needed new challenges. It's satisfying to cross out a goal, but it's even more exciting to write down new ones. So I wrote down some newer, crazier goals. Win an Oscar and meet Snoop Dogg. How to Asian in Hollywood. I auditioned for another immigrant role that couldn't have been more different than Jing Yang. It was for Patriots Day, a dramatic feature recounting the 2013 Boston Marathon bombing, directed by Peter Berg, starring Mark Wahlberg, Kevin Bacon, John Goodman, J.K. Simmons, and Michelle Monaghan. The cast of the film was more impressive than The Last Suppers. My role was based on a real-life character named Dun Meng. Dun, or as he liked to be called, Danny, was a Chinese immigrant just like me. He had just moved from China to Boston when he was carjacked at gunpoint and kidnapped by the terrorists after the Boston Marathon bombing. Danny's heroic escape played a key role in the capture of the two terrorist brothers. He was a real American hero. Playing him would be an honor. It would also be my first dramatic role in a feature film. This was the new challenge I've been looking for. Every article I read about Danny, I became more in awe of his heroism. He was held up at gunpoint and then loaded explosives in the back of his car. The terrorists drove Danny around for a nerve-wracking 90 minutes. They were on their way to Times Square, New York for another bombing. When they pulled over at the gas station, Danny took a chance and made a heroic escape. He sprinted out of the car, nearly escaping the grasp of one of the terrorists. Then he made the 911 call that would help law enforcement track down the vehicle, which led to the shootout in Watertown and the eventual apprehension of these two heinous terrorists. I found this incredible surveillance footage of Danny sprinting away from the terrorists and a chilling recording of the real 911 call from Danny. It was terrifying and intense. I tried to put myself in Danny's shoes that night, and I'm not sure if I'll have the courage or presence of mind to do what he did. Danny Meng is a hero. I auditioned for the prolific casting director Sheila Jaffe twice before auditioning in front of the director Peter Berg. Sheila was so patient with me and really gave me great directions before I went in for the real callback with Pete. Pete and I started just casually chatting about stand-up comedy, and then Pete just rolled into the scene. He pretended to carjack me like the terrorists did to Danny. I was ready. I sprinted out of the imaginary car and hid behind the imaginary gas station cashier like I'd seen in the real-life surveillance video. Then I pretended to make the 911 call just like I heard on the actual recorded version. Pete was acting with me every step of the way. We were in the moment. At the end of the audition, I felt an ounce of what Danny went through that night, and it was terrifying. Pete asked me, "So how do you feel about cutting your hair for this role?" "Yeah, I'll definitely cut my hair for this role." "I didn't ask you if you would cut your hair. I asked how do you feel about cutting your hair." I got the part. I was nervous about how I'd be received as a dramatic actor, but I was more nervous about how Danny Meng would receive me as an actor playing him in a movie. We had to get it right. That was the mantra on set. The movie wasn't about us. It was about honoring the victims and the heroes of this event. And my role was to tell the real story of Danny Meng, an average guy who became a hero in desperate times. I made sure his specific Sichuan Chinese accent was genuine, and the story was accurate, and his emotions were real. Danny was a Chinese immigrant from the Sichuan province. He had a Chinese accent, but it was very different than Jing Yang's. He had a very specific Sichuan accent where he pronounces N's in the place of L's. So instead of saying lonely, he would say like, noni. I worked on the accent every day for at least 4 hours for the month leading up to filming. I went to the grocery store, the post office, and the mechanic speaking in that accent. What I learned was more than the accent itself. I noticed how crudely people treated foreigners. The mechanic was quickly annoyed because he could barely understand me. The cashier at the grocery store avoided eye contact, and the post office lady couldn't be more frustrated trying to explain the difference between priority and first-class mail to me. This reminded me of my own struggles when I first came to this country. I looked up to Danny as a hero, and I empathized with Danny as a fellow immigrant. In one of the opening scenes of the film, Danny FaceTimes his parents back home in China, and they speak Mandarin to each other. They had cast a father who spoke Mandarin with a heavy Cantonese accent. The American audience might not notice the difference, but to a Chinese speaker, that's like somebody playing a British character with a southern drawl. To me, that was unacceptable. We had to get it right. So I went up to Pete and voiced my concerns. Pete agreed. "Let's find you a new dad," he said. A light bulb went off in my head, and I told Pete, "Why don't we just hire my real dad? He's an actor." Pete trusted my word as an actor and appreciated my sentiment as a son. They flew my real dad out to Boston the following week, and he played my movie dad in Patriots Day. That scene is the best father and son memento we can ever have in our family. The entire film shot in Boston. We stayed in a hotel that eerily overlooked the finish line of the Boston Marathon, the same place where the bombs went off in 2013. I was able to get in touch with Danny, who still lived across the river in Cambridge. We hit it off right away. We spoke Mandarin to each other and shared our Chinese immigrant experiences. He created and managed a startup food delivery app called Rush Runner that specialized in delivering the most authentic Chinese foods in Boston. His real life wasn't too far from my pretend life on Silicon Valley. Danny told me, "I've seen you on Two Broke Girls." Apparently, Two Broke Girls was one of the most popular American shows in China, and my two lines on the show were my first introduction to Danny. He was so open to sharing everything with me. We sat down at Danny's shared office space as he recounted the fateful night to me. I had a good sense of what happened that night through my research. I wanted to find out what Danny was thinking during that horrifying night. Danny said, I thought about my family, my friends, and how I was never going to see them again. That hit me. What would I do if I thought I would never see my family and friends again? I felt honored that Danny would share these emotional details with me. Then he told me one detail that deeply affected me. When a terrorist jumped into the car and pointed his gun at me, he asked me, is there anyone who cared about you here? And I said no. So I asked Danny, I'm like, why did you say no? Didn't you want to plead for his empathy? No, he wasn't asking me because he cared. He was asking me to see if there will be anyone who will call the police if I'm gone. So I said no. Nobody cared about me here. Each answer he gave to the terrorist that night could mean life or death. Even with a gun pointed to his head, Danny kept his smarts and composure. Then Danny told me, and really, that was the truth. Nobody really cared about me here. I was new to America. Most of my friends were in China. That gave me the chills. Every immigrant has felt that way. Nobody cares about me here. I know I definitely felt that way when I first came to America. I might not have been able to relate to being carjacked at gunpoint by terrorists, but I could surely relate to the loneliness of being an immigrant. I took that part of the story to Peter Berg the next morning. We have to put that in the movie, I said to Pete. Then Pete, being one of the best directors I've ever worked with, said, let's try it. He was the ultimate actor's director. He started his career as an actor and he understood how actors work. He didn't give us any technical notes and he just let us play out the scenes. There were no marks and he never set to open up the camera. He let us stay in the moment to play it real and get it right. I was nervous about filming the carjacking scene. It was a tough experience to recreate what happened that night in the car, and I needed to do right by Danny. With Pete's directing style and the great actors Temo Melakitze and Alex Wolff who portrayed the terrorist brothers, everything felt so real. I completely broke down during one take. I thought about my own family and how I'll never see them again. Those weren't tears that I learned to conjure from acting classes. They were real. The scene felt so real that I had nightmares for a week after the shoot. I would wake up in the middle of the night and think someone was standing on the foot of my bed. I could only imagine what Danny had actually gone through after the real carjacking. Patriots Day wasn't nominated for any awards, but it was the proudest thing I'd ever done in my career, to portray a Chinese immigrant hero in such a quintessential American story. Everyone who knows Danny's story thinks he's the hero, except for Danny. Danny said, I don't think I'm a hero. A hero is somebody who is willing to sacrifice himself to save somebody else. I was just trying to save myself that night. To me, his humbleness makes him even more of a hero. Danny makes me proud to be an immigrant. Danny called me after he saw an early screening of the movie. He said to me, you were very good. That meant more to me than winning any award. I take pride in playing immigrant characters. I've come across people who had negative opinion about playing Asian characters with an accent. I've even met Asian actors who won't audition for a role that has an Asian accent. They believe these accented characters reinforce the stereotype of an Asian being the constant foreigner. Frankly, I can't relate. I was an immigrant. I had an accent. And no matter how Americanized I've become, no matter how much Jay-Z I listen to, I will always be an immigrant. Just because I don't speak English with an accent anymore doesn't mean that I'm better than the people who do. My job as an actor is to not judge anyone and portray a character with humanity. There are real people with real Asian accents in the world. I used to be one of them, and I'm damn proud of it. To me, the issue is not the people who speak with an Asian accent. It's the perception of the accent itself. So if you regard a Spanish accent, it's considered sexy, and it helped her become an international sex symbol. Peter Sellers' Inspector Clouseau French accent in the Pink Panther movies was praised in the comedy world, and it earned him a Golden Globe nomination for Best Actor. But why is the Chinese accent considered foreign and nerdy? Jing Yang is more than a fresh-off-the-boat immigrant. He's also a funny, devious little asshole. Danny Meng is not just a foreign Chinese student. He's a real-life American hero who helped capture the Boston Marathon bombing terrorists. I want people to see these guys and say, wow, that Chinese dude is awesome. And I want girls to watch these roles and say, I need to find myself a Jing Yang on Danny Meng. These guys are fucking sexy. My mission is not to avoid playing an immigrant. My mission is to make Asian immigrants as sexy as Ryan Gosling. How to be sexy. My sexiness was finally noticed when I was cast in the movie Life of the Party. It's a Melissa McCarthy, Ben Falcone comedy about a mom who goes back to college and joins her daughter's sorority. The description for my character is Maddie's perfect boyfriend. And as this small world would have it, Molly Gordon, who played my girlfriend Maddie in the film, is also the daughter of Brian Gordon, the director who wanted to cast me for Sin City Saints, which led me to being a series regular on Silicon Valley. Playing a boyfriend might not seem like a big deal, but playing a white girl's boyfriend is like the holy grail for Asian actors. It has always been rare for an Asian male to go out with white female in mainstream media. Jackie Chan never had a white girl. Bruce Lee married a white girl in real life, but he never had a white girl in the movies. But on the flip side, Lucy Liu had plenty of white beaus. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. We don't see a lot of Asian men with white women on screen, so we don't risk putting a lot of Asian men with white women on screen. I was happy to help change that. I was actually a bit uncomfortable being the perfect boyfriend. I was used to being the funny guy on screen, and I have never been the perfect boyfriend in real life. My whole life, I've always felt like I had to be funny to compensate for my lack of aesthetics. I felt insecure about playing the straight man boyfriend. What do I bring to the table? Looks? Charms? How could I be the perfect boyfriend when I couldn't even navigate through a Tinder date? I could hear my dad saying, "You, Jimmy, perfect boyfriend, come on." But Melissa and Ben believed that I could be the perfect boyfriend before I did. They never thought for a second that it was unusual to have an Asian boyfriend and a white girl on the big screen. They saw me beyond my ethnicity. I had to put my insecurity aside and put the Asian nation on my back. This was not just about me. This was about making all my Asian brothers look sexy. So I decided to do some research on how to be sexy. The movie shot in Atlanta. On a Saturday night, I went out to a dance club by myself. For research for the role, obviously. See, I'm not usually a dance club type of guy, but when in Atlanta, I was supposed to be sexy. The club was a cool underground spot playing the latest Dirty South hip-hop joints. I threw back a couple of drinks, and I was ready to cut a rug. Then a cute girl approached me and asked, "Do you want some Molly?" Now, see, I'm usually not a Molly type of guy, but when in Atlanta, I was supposed to be sexy. So she dabbed her finger in a small plastic bag of white powder and stuffed that finger right into my mouth. I'd never done Molly before. 10 minutes later, everything felt like Disneyland. I was in love with everything and everyone. I had the confidence to go up to every girl in the club. I finally felt sexy. I'm sure in reality, I was probably dancing like somebody's drunk aunt at a quinceañera. 3 hours later, I was still feeling great. The club was closing, but I wanted to keep dancing. 6 hours later, I was still ready to party, but everything was already closed. 12 hours later, I was pacing around in my hotel room with my heart beating out of my chest. My body was dead tired, but my mind was still wide awake. I drank a couple glasses of red wine, and I took some NyQuil to no avail. Next thing I knew, I hadn't slept for 40 hours, and I was on the brink of cardiac arrest. That definitely wasn't Molly. Pretty sure the finger was laced with meth. I had to be back on set in 8 hours. I lay on my bed with my eyes wide open. I didn't sleep a wink that weekend and got on set with massive dark circles under my eyes. My eye bags felt like grocery bags and my face looked like a panda. I'm pretty sure I aged 5 years in 2 days. I pretended to be a perfect boyfriend while my body was about to shut down from methamphetamine. I somehow managed to power through the scenes without collapsing. Luckily, the scene was an 80s party scene, so everyone looked ridiculous anyway. Maybe this was method acting for this party boy. Or more precisely, meth acting. I survived that day and practically went into a coma and slept for 20 hours. Nobody ever found out this perfect boyfriend was doing meth on the weekend. Until now. Little did they know Jimmy was far from a perfect boyfriend. He was a dipshit who let random girls stick drugs in his mouth. Fresh to death. I got a call from my manager one afternoon. Hey, you want to go to the All-Deaf Movie Awards? The All-Deaf Movie Awards was like the urban Oscars. For you guys who don't remember what urban meant, it means black people stuff. It was an award show created by Russell Simmons to champion diversity in film. So of course I went. The next thing I knew, I was in the same building as some of my heroes. Snoop Dogg, Ice Cube, LL Cool J. I looked at the name tags at my table. Tommy Davidson, Mark Curry, Too Short. Two of the best comedians and one of the most legendary rappers that I grew up watching on BET. There was an award that night called Best Performance by an Asian Not Asked to Use an Accent. I'm not making this up. I was invited to attend the show because I was nominated for that award for my role in Patriots Day, in which I did have an accent. The other nominees were Randall Park and Donnie Yen from Star Wars, who naturally had a Chinese accent. The award was supposed to be ironic, really. It should have been called Best Asian Homie Award. And as if it was a dream come true, I won. It was the pinnacle of being an Asian actor who grew up watching BET. This was the very first award I'd ever won for my acting, and it couldn't have been more fitting to receive it in front of everyone who taught me English from BET. This was my Oscar. I jumped on stage to receive my golden All-Deaf statue. It looked like an Oscar, except the dude on the statue was the dude from Superfly. I gave a speech in front of all my heroes. Wow, an Asian winning an award on the All-Deaf show. This is a dream come true. I looked over to Russell Simmons. Thank you, Russ. You have no idea who I am, but that's okay. This is big, man. I guess I'm doing it on behalf of Jackie Chan, Yao Ming, Lucy Liu. This is about diversity. I was an immigrant. I was a dude with an accent, and I learned to speak English by watching BET Rap City with Snoop, Cube, LL Cool J, and Def Comedy Jam. So all my heroes are here. Thank you guys very much. And then I pointed to my heroes in the audience, and I saw Snoop Dogg clapping through a cloud of weed smoke surrounding him. Then I pointed to Snoop Dogg's mentor in the audience, the infamous pimp who is always dressed up in green and gold. And I signed off with one of his signature pimp catchphrases. Thank you, Don Magic Juan. You're my hero, man. Green for the money, go for the honey. When I got off the stage, I walked through a thick cloud of weed smoke, and I saw Snoop Dogg. Snoop gave me the coolest handshake, and he said, good job, homie. This was the crowning moment of my career. And now, I can cross out two of my newest goals. Win an Oscar, or slash, All-Deaf Movie Award, and meet Snoop Dogg. I was invited to do a podcast at Too Short Studio the next week, and I got to hang out with the legend himself. Too Short is a West Coast rapper whose career spans from the 80s with his hit singles such as Gettin' It, I'm a Player, and The World is Filled from Biggie's Life After Death album. To more recently, the Bay Area hit song, Blow the Whistle, where he famously says in the song, what's my favorite word, bitch? I'm just quoting the lyrics, that's actually what he says. He is known as the man who made the word bitch famous in rap songs. His studio is a giant warehouse converted into three recording studios, a live soundstage, a room filled with arcade games, and full living quarters. It was every artist's dream to be in that place. On the podcast, we talked about BET, strip clubs, and weed. For a kid that grew up in Hong Kong, I had a lot of common interests with a rapper who grew up in Oakland. I took a hit off of Too Short's blunt, and I coughed for the next 5 minutes. He laughed and said, you can't handle that Too Short weed. And he was right. One hit, and I was high for the next 8 hours. I confessed to Short during the podcast. So I actually used to make beats before I got into comedy, and I showed him some of my beats. He started bobbing his head. This is good, he said. That was the ultimate stamp of approval in hip-hop. All the days spent making beats for the Yellow Panthers have finally paid off. And you guys check out the PDF. There's a really cool picture of me, DJ Bobby Loco, and Too Short at my Golden All-Deaf Movie Award. But I was so high, I had no recollection of taking this picture. I thought selling beats to Fudgestick.com was the pinnacle of my music career. Now I found a new frontier collaborating with Too Short. Short rapped on one of my songs, and I was featured on one of his music videos. It was one of my lifelong dreams come true. Stand-up and acting are my bread and butter, but there is always a special place in my heart for hip-hop. When we shot the music video for the song called You Came to Party, I knew exactly how to make it rain on that party bus from the hours of research I did on BET Rap City. The song also happened to be one of the end credit song on Silicon Valley in Season 4. Jing Yang and Too Short made for a new dynamic duo. This time, instead of asking myself, now what? I had learned to enjoy the now. Looking back to see how far I come from making music at Chris's apartment to making music in Too Short studio gave me a brand new perspective. It's exciting to chase after a new goal, but it's meaningless if you can't sit down and enjoy the moment. Life is like buying a flat screen TV. The day you buy your 55-inch flat screen and throw away your old Zenith 2 TV is one of the best days of your life. You call all your buddies over and watch Planet Earth for 8 hours. It's magnificent. That flat screen marks a milestone for your success. You've made it. Then 2 months later, you get used to the 55-inch TV. It's just another TV to you now. You watch The Price is Right on it, and you scream, $1! Bit $1, you fucking idiot! Just like you did when you had your Zenith tube TV. And sadly, you can't even go back to your Zenith tube TV if you wanted to. You have tricked your brain into a new standard, and there is nowhere to go but up. So, you set a new goal to buy the newest 75-inch 4K TV. You save an extra $100 every paycheck, and it feels exciting. You visualize the awesomeness of 4K in your dreams every day. You finally go to Best Buy and pick up your new baby. It's the happiest day of your life, and the picture is better than your eyeballs can even handle. You invite all your buddies over, and you watch Monday Night Football in majestic 4K. You can even see a piece of Tom Brady's perfect brown hair flow in the wind as he delivers the perfect spiral. It's so awesome, you get hard just a little bit. Then, another 2 months later, you're sitting there alone screaming at Brady because you're coming up short in your fantasy football league. Throw another touchdown, you fucking asshole! And now the 75-inch TV becomes the new normal, yet again. Your amazing TV becomes just another TV. You can't even go watch games at Buffalo Wild Wings with your boys anymore because their 65-inch TV looks like the old Zenith tube TV now. So, you go back to watching The Price is Right, verbally abusing the contestants. Everything is still the exact same as when you had the Zenith tube TV. Then, they roll out a new OLED technology, super high-def 85-inch TV. You're motivated again, striving to get to the new standard. But now, you're wise. You understand the cycle. You look back and see how far you've came from the crappy Zenith, and it gives you a whole new appreciation for the 75-inch TV you have in front of you. You learn to enjoy Monday Night Football again while you remain excited for the new OLED 85-inch TV in your future. Chapter 10. How to American. I finally became a U.S. citizen in 2015. I had been qualified to become a U.S. citizen for several years, but it cost $725 to file the paperwork. Look, I wasn't unpatriotic. I just didn't have $725 to spare until 2015. The main difference between a U.S. permanent resident with a green card and a U.S. citizen are the right to vote, the right to sit on a hung jury, and the right to not get deported if you claim you're a U.S. citizen at the Tijuana border. I was finally convinced that I needed to become a U.S. citizen when a friend told me that his buddy with a green card was deported after he was charged with domestic abuse. Look, I wasn't planning on beating my imaginary wife, but I realized I could have gotten deported for something trivially illegal, like smoking weed in public. That wasn't a chance I was willing to take. Just to be clear, I think domestic violence is terrible, and all perpetrators should be deported to an island where they beat each other in a giant octagon, kind of like a Thunderdome for assholes. All the logical factors aside, truthfully, I did feel a great sense of pride in finally becoming a U.S. citizen. To become a U.S. citizen, I had to pass a civics test to prove that I had a good enough understanding of American history and the English language. I had to prepare for a Q&A from a booklet, 100 civics questions. Questions such as, how many justices are on the Supreme Court? What is the economic system of the United States? What does the judicial branch do? I've seen enough of the jaywalking segment on the Tonight Show with Jay Leno to know that most U.S.-born citizens wouldn't even know the answers to these questions. I had to study those questions like it was the SAT. See, they should have let me pass the test just based on the amount of Bud Light and American football I consumed over the last 10 years. I think the test should have had more relevant everyday American questions like, what constitutes as a pass interference in the NFL? What's Snoop Dogg's real name? Who is Leo DiCaprio currently dating? The NFL, Snoop, and Leo are just as quintessentially American as the Supreme Court. The test took place in a stuffy room inside of an old brick building in downtown LA. I don't know why all government facilities have to look as dreadfully boring as possible. To properly welcome these potential new American citizens, the test should have taken place in a strip club. Leave a good impression and show everyone what America is really about. After an hour of sitting on the most uncomfortable government-issued plastic chair, they finally call my name. Man Shing Ouyang? It was exactly the same as my first day in school in America. You can just call me Jimmy. The lady who interviewed me was a woman with a thick Jamaican accent. I'm pretty sure I was more Americanized than my American citizenship interviewer. I bet you she didn't even know what constitutes as a pass interference in the NFL. I answered every question correctly like I was Ken Jennings on Jeopardy. After acing that test, I thought I'll get to meet the president and he'll congratulate me on my new citizenship. Instead, I had to wait another several months to become a U.S. citizen at the naturalization ceremony. All I could think of during that time was, Jimmy, don't get arrested for smoking weed in public. I was one of 3,000 people from 80 different countries at the Los Angeles Convention Center for the naturalization ceremony. It was a magical moment for everyone. I was surrounded by soon-to-be U.S. citizens of every color, race, and religion. Sitting next to me was a Mexican couple in their 60s. Behind me was a Persian dude who looked like a classmate from Beverly Hills High School. And in front of me was an old Chinese couple who reminded me of my grandparents. It was truly a beautiful sight. People were crying from jubilation. Whatever journey they went through to become American citizens finally culminated in this moment that they shared with fellow immigrants from all over the world. For me, it was especially sentimental because it meant I had $725 in my checking account. We sat down as the local politician took to the podium and congratulated us on this monumental day. Then, they played a song accompanied by a music video on the big projector screen to welcome the 3,000 newest citizens to the U.S. of A. The video started with a classic eagle flying by, followed by beautiful farmland and a slow zoom-in shot of Mount Rushmore. Then, the song came on. I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free. The Mexican couple next to me put their hands on their chests as if it was the national anthem. I didn't have the heart to tell them that this wasn't a Star-Spangled Banner. It was actually Lee Greenwood's God Bless the USA. Everyone around me started to tear up. But I was so distracted by the crappy music video to be fully in touch with my emotions. Really, America? This is the best music video we have? Any music video from BET would be better than an eagle flying over an empty cornfield. Instead of Lee Greenwood's God Bless the USA, I suggest we play Jay-Z's Big Pimping at the naturalization ceremony. Instead of eagles flying by and Mount Rushmore, it should be partying on a yacht, popping Cristal with bikini models, man. We should show the newly anointed American citizens what it truly means to live the American dream. We're doing big pimping up in NYC. It's just that Jigga Man Pimp C and B-U-M-B. I would have cried if they play that. God bless America. Everyone congratulated me for being an American citizen, but I didn't feel any different. I was still Asian. I was now officially an American person with an American passport, but I still looked like the same Asian kid who didn't know the Pledge of Allegiance. Nobody in any part of the world is going to come up to me and say, "Hey, American guy, cool passport, Rocky Balboa, yeah." No, random people still look at me and holler, "Hey, Karate Kid, Jackie Chan, Bruce Lee." The color of my passport doesn't matter. Most people always see me as Asian before they'll think I'm American. It's hard to put ethnicities aside in the melting pot of America. Sometimes I identify so much with my ethnic background that I forget what I'm really about as a person. I went to Winnipeg, Canada for my first trip as an American citizen with my freshly minted U.S. passport. It was for a weekend stand-up stint at the Rumors Comedy Club, opening up for Sean Wayans from the Wayans Brothers. I got off the plane and strutted through the border security with my beautiful blue American passport. Finally, I'm an American that can't be told to go back to where I came from by the stupid border patrol. I laid my passport down in front of a Canadian border patrol officer like it was a badge of honor. She gave me a warm Canadian smile, probably impressed by how American I was. Then she flipped through the empty pages and looked at my name. Now, it's Manxing Jimmy Ouyang. Jimmy is finally my official American middle name, not just a nickname. She looked up and asked, "So, are you here for business or pleasure?" When I was young, I was taught by my parents to always say pleasure at border security for our family vacations. So, I automatically replied, "Pleasure." And I gave her a confident American grin. She asked, "So, what brought you here to Winnipeg?" Now I had to back up my pleasure story, but it's okay. I'm a professional actor. I got this. "Oh, just to get away from LA, you know, all the craziness and traffic. I thought it would be nice to go somewhere quiet and have a little vacation in Winnipeg." Nailed it. Tom Hanks. "So, you're not here to visit family or anything?" "Oh, I mean, I have a friend in town that I'm planning to see." "What's his name?" Sean Warner? "Sir, why don't you come with me?" Fuck. She led me to the back room where once again, there was a man holding an assault rifle. I was once again detained at the border. It was like deja vu. It doesn't matter which citizenship I possess. I should generally stop lying at any country's border. She whispered something to the Teflon-vested man and she took a seat across from me. Her Canadian smile was gone. She said, "Why don't you tell me the truth?" You know when your mom catches you in an obvious lie, but you still try to stand your ground because you don't want to get caught lying? This was exactly that. Except mom doesn't have an armed guard behind her. "I was telling the truth, ma'am. I'm here to get away for a little vacation, here to have fun." And then she said, "Nobody comes to have fun at Winnipeg." I couldn't argue with that. I guess I underestimated just how shitty Winnipeg was. I didn't know what to say. She typed something into a computer. "Are you a stand-up comedian?" How does she know that? "Are you opening up for Sean Wayans this weekend?" "What the fuck? Is she sidekick?" No. I resisted with one last lie. Then she turned the computer screen around and showed me. "Then why does it say on your Facebook page, 'I'm going to be in Winnipeg, Canada this week. Rumors Comedy Club. Opening for Sean Wayans. Get your tickets now.'" That was the most embarrassing moment of my life. I wish the guard would shoot me with the assault rifle and put me out of my misery. I put my hands over my face, not sure if I should cry or laugh at my own stupidity. She pressed on. "Why did you feel like you had to lie?" The jig was up. Now I had to beg for mercy. "I'm sorry, ma'am. I'm just a stupid person. I have no idea why I lied. I've never been on a business trip before. I'm so sorry." She shook her head at this pathetic liar. And then she looked over to the armed guard. "What should we do with him?" The guard said, "Well, it's up to you. You can let him stay or send him back to where he came from." The same words the Tijuana Border Patrol said to me 10 years ago haunted me again. But then I realized, this time, send him back to where he came from meant sending me back to America, not Hong Kong. As twisted as it may sound, I felt pretty good about that sentence. Even though I was a stupid liar, for the first time in my life, somebody actually saw me as an American citizen, not a Chinese immigrant. On the brink of getting deported from Canada, I felt more American than ever. America is now where I came from. I made it. I'm an American. She decided to have mercy on me and let me go through to Winnipeg, where I performed 9 sold-out shows with Sean Waynes. Who said nobody comes to Winnipeg to have fun? Winnipeg was a blast for this American. How to Hong Kong? I hadn't been back to Hong Kong in 17 years. A part of me had always avoided going back to the motherland. I was nervous it would ruin the perfect childhood I remembered. I didn't want to risk changing the perception of the positive memories I had from Hong Kong. What if Hong Kong is nothing like I actually remembered? I finally had an undeniable excuse to go back to Hong Kong when I landed a role in the Crazy Rich Asians movie filming in Singapore. Crazy Rich Asians is based on the New York Times best-selling book of the same name, written by Kevin Kwan. It takes us into a semi-fictional world of the ridiculously fabulous lifestyle and first-world problems of the filthy rich billionaire families living in Singapore. Kevin wanted to introduce a contemporary Asian to the North American audience. When the movie was announced, it made waves in the Asian community. Crazy Rich Asians would mark the first American major studio movie in 25 years to feature a full Asian cast since The Joy Luck Club. The actors, the producers, and the director John Chu all share the same sense of pride and responsibility to properly represent Asians in mainstream media with this monumental opportunity. This was our chance to show the world that we are just as brilliant, just as good-looking, and just as funny as everyone else in Hollywood. This was our key to open the doors for all the amazing Asian talents in cinema. The most talented, most beautiful, and the funniest Asian actors from every corner of the world came together for this movie. There were no egos or superstars on the set. We all understood that we were making something bigger than ourselves. With Chinese legend Michelle Yeoh, Chinese-American actors Constance Wu, Harry Shum Jr., Nora Lum, and myself. Korean-American comedy superstar Ken Jeong, Filipino-American comedian Nico Santos, Chinese-British actress Gemma Chen, Japanese-British actress Sonoya Mizuno, Chinese-Australian actors Chris Pang, Ronnie Chang, Remy He, and local Singaporean A-listers Fiona Shi and Pierre Pong, and our British-Malaysian lead, Henry Golding. It was my first time working with all of these amazing talents, but there was an immediate familiarity among all of us. Even though we're all brought up in different countries, where some of us were immigrants and some of us were second and third generation, we shared the same experience of growing up Asian. We had all experienced being seen as Asian before being seen as American, British, or Australian. We all shared the same experience of calling every older family friend uncle and auntie. And we all grew up thinking it was a far-fetched idea to become an actor. It was an incredible feeling to be among these amazingly talented Asian brothers and sisters who understood each other. Everyone made each other feel even more proud to be Asian. For once in my life, I wanted to flaunt my Asian side instead of hiding it to fit in as somebody else. Ever since I immigrated to America, I tried my hardest to be American. I made it a point to make friends from every ethnic background instead of just Asian friends. I fought so hard to not be grouped in with other Asians in college. I didn't want to be the Chinese kid who only hung out with other Chinese kids. I thought that was so lame and stereotypical. But after the Crazy Rich Asian shoot, I finally got it. It wasn't about choosing to hang out with people of the same skin tone. It was about hanging out with people who shared the same point of view because they had gone through the same experiences. One of my favorite lines in the Crazy Rich Asian script was, "I didn't have to explain myself that I'm Asian here. I'm just another person." During the Crazy Rich Asian shoot in Singapore, everyone saw me as who I am. I wasn't just the Asian kid. I could just be the funny guy instead of the Asian guy who is funny. I felt a weight lifted off my shoulders. It was the first time in 17 years that I didn't have to prove to anyone, or myself, that I was more than a token Asian guy. Crazy Rich Asians made me want to get in touch with my roots instead of running away from them. I flew to Hong Kong after we wrapped filming in Singapore. I went back to the motherland with a newly found sense of pride in my culture and myself. It had been so long that I got the same culture shock when I arrived in Hong Kong as I did the first day when I arrived in Los Angeles. Instead of 8-lane boulevards filled with cars and strip malls, the streets in Hong Kong were packed with a sea of people and shops in a concrete jungle. The alleyways told the history of Hong Kong, where classic barbecue ducks hang from restaurant windows, century-old flea markets selling household items, and mysterious fortune tellers preaching to the superstitious. I was captivated by the image of an old man wearing a wife beater pushing an old wooden dolly in front of an ultra-modern 50-story glass building. The old Chinese culture blends perfectly with the new westernized world. The city felt alive. In LA, I can walk for 15 minutes and not see a single soul in the land of strip malls. In Hong Kong, you can't help but bump shoulders with the hundreds of people crossing the streets with purpose. There's an adventure in every corner of this controlled chaos. Even with all the people and stimulation in the streets, I felt a sense of ease in Hong Kong. It felt like home. I was still a big city Hong Kong boy at heart. I never really lost my Asianness. I just covered it up with an American facade. In Hong Kong, I didn't have to answer the question, am I Chinese or am I American? I was just another person. It was just me. The weight of being an immigrant and the weight of being defined as an Asian American were gone. Things that seemed like stereotypes in America were just normal in Hong Kong. Instead of an Asian guy eating weird chicken feet at a stereotypical dim sum restaurant, I was just a guy having lunch. I had forgotten that there was a place in the world where I wasn't judged based on my ethnicity. And I was the norm. I felt at peace. I visited longtime family friends at the Shanghai Club, where they serve some of the most authentic Shanghainese cuisine. I visited my granduncle, Frank, who has always been a baller wearing Italian suits. He took me to an exclusive members-only restaurant called the American Club. I know it's ironic to fly 7,000 miles to Hong Kong to go to the American Club, but that was the best ribeye I ever had on any side of the world. It was dry-aged USDA prime beef mixed with the culinary skills of the top chefs in Hong Kong. I walked down the street I grew up on, Tin Hau Miu Do, or Tin Hau Miu Road. The 25-story yellowish apartment building still looked the same to me. The giant tree on the block looked just as big as my first day of elementary school. Maybe it grew proportionately to my size. I walked down the steps to the Tin Hau Temple. I used to be so scared of the statues of Chinese mythological characters in front of the temple when I was a kid. Now, they just look like ugly cartoon characters. I sat down in front of the temple and was immediately bitten by a mosquito, a familiar pest in the humidity of Hong Kong. The itch reminded me of my childhood summers. I went over to the Chinese pharmacy for some herbal mosquito cream. The pharmacy had everything from Tylenol to Chinese herbs to a glass container filled with dry scallops, a signature Hong Kong delicacy. The place smelled like fish jerky wrapped in a Band-Aid. I strolled past the sneaker store where my dad bought me my first pair of Jordans. It was a pair of Jordan 12s that came out in the 1996-97 NBA season when Michael Jordan defeated the Utah Jazz in the NBA Finals. Those fresh J's made me easily the coolest kid in school that year. On the same street, I found one of our favorite hole-in-the-wall restaurants that specialize in beef brisket soup. They have been perfecting the brisket for 40 years, and it's the only thing they make in the restaurant. A bite of the tender brisket brought me back to my first soccer practice in the nearby Victoria Park, where my mom rewarded me with that delicious brisket soup. Everything was just as good as I remembered. Just a few months before the trip, I reconnected with a couple of my grade school friends from Hong Kong through Facebook. My old classmate Ku Chin came across my stand-up set from the Arsenio Hall show on YouTube. In the set, I talked about being from Hong Kong So he looked me up on Wikipedia and found my Chinese name. And I was indeed the same kid he sat next to in third grade. So Cool friended me on Facebook, and through him I also connected with Darren C., one of my best friends from Hong Kong. I couldn't believe they managed to find me after all those years. I tried to stay in touch with them when I first moved to America, but that was the year 2000. It was before Facebook, FaceTime calls, and even MySpace. I had to use my mom's international phone card to chat with my friends back in Hong Kong. And I was only 13 years old. I didn't know how to properly stay in touch with my long-distance friends. So we slowly all faded away from each other's lives. After 17 years, we were about to hang out in Hong Kong, all thanks to Arsenio Hall. I met up with Koo and Darren at a hotel bar on top of central Hong Kong. When I walked in to find them, I had no idea who to look for. I had no idea what they looked like after all those years. I have seen puberty turn an ugly duckling into a swan, and I've also seen it turn a cute kid into a ninja turtle. I almost went up to two random dudes and gave them a hug. Then I heard, "Jimmy!" I turned around and saw the same kids I played tag with in third grade. They were still the same guys. Koo was still the bad boy with a cool haircut. Darren was still the nice kid with a gracious smile. Chatting with them in Cantonese brought back all the memories we had in grade school. We chatted about our jobs, girlfriends we had, and our other friends from school. I thought I'd walk into the bar as the cool dude who made it in Hollywood. But I was pretty sure they were both making way more money than I was. Cool now runs a successful arcade business in Hong Kong, and he has a healthy collection of Ferraris and Lamborghinis. And Darren works at one of the top investment banking firms, and he just bought a multi-million dollar condo in Hong Kong. They were the real crazy rich Asians. I was just an actor pretending to be them. But all that didn't matter. We were just happy to see each other after all these years. When I came home to LA from Hong Kong, I felt like I had left my real home to come back to a place I called home. Before I was ever an immigrant, before I was an Asian American, I was just a kid who didn't even know what either of those things meant. I've spent my entire adult life figuring out how to American. Fitting in became the most consistent part of my life. And no matter how American I try to be, I'd always felt like an outsider. And no matter how long ago I left Hong Kong, it would always feel like home to me. My trip to Hong Kong gave me a chance to define myself as more than just the Asian guy in America, to see past my own ethnicity and evaluate what I'm really about. I'm not the 13-year-old Hong Kong Jimmy anymore, and I'll never be the all-American guy. I'm an amalgamation of both. I'm a Chinese-American Hong Kong-born immigrant who learned English from BET. If it wasn't for my family, I would not have immigrated from Hong Kong to Los Angeles. And if it wasn't for the American mindset of pursuing what I love, I would not have been a stand-up comedian. I don't have to be solely defined by where I came from, and I'm more than just where I end up. I'm as Chinese as I'm American. Can I see myself living in Hong Kong again? I mean, the people are great, the food is amazing, and it's one of the most vibrant cities in the world. But there's one very important thing that America has to offer. The same thing that made my family and so many others before us immigrate to America. Boundless opportunities. That is what makes the American dream uniquely American. When I quit finance to become a stand-up comedian, my parents thought I was crazy. And they were right. I would be considered insane anywhere else in the world except for America. Americans are encouraged to dream big and do anything we set our minds to. The United States is the only country where the pursuit of happiness is the right of its citizens. Jay-Z went from the Marcy Project to drinking champagne on a yacht and marrying Beyonce. I went from struggling with the English language to doing stand-up comedy and becoming a Hollywood actor. There might always be ignorant people who wish I'll go back to where I came from, but I embrace America the same way it has embraced me as its citizen. My American dream is as real as it comes. Epilogue. I told you guys there'll be an epilogue, so this book will look super official. I can now find the humor when I look back at my first day of school in America. but it wasn't very funny for the 13-year-old Chinese kid who had to navigate through the alien world at the time. He was lost. He was scared. He wanted to go home. It was hard. Every immigrant has gone through a difficult journey. My story